Okay, so I think without any further delay, let's see if Dr. Pete's on the air. Are you there with us, Dr. Pete?
Yes.
Hi. Just so that people who perhaps have never listened to the show or have never heard you, would you just give an outline of your academic and professional background before we get into tonight's subject?
I studied humanities first, largely at University of Oregon, a year at Ohio State, some in Mexico and so on. But then I went to the University of Oregon for 4 years to study biology. And I've been concentrating on biology now for 40 years or more.
Okay. And I know that you're intimately involved in, for want of a better phrase, uncovering the truth behind various claims and propaganda almost from I would think some of the pharmaceutical and other corporations with how they would market their product to us as consumers, and how that marketing is really not very scientific a lot of the times, and there is scientific evidence to show an argument to support most, if not all, of what you you write about in your newsletters. And just reminding people that listen to the show, Dr. Pete doesn't sell anything. He's very much into research. And a lot of what you do, I know from our own experience and from people that have contacted you, is very altruistic. So tonight's show, like I said at the beginning here, is going to be surrounding longevity and the popular sort of popularly recently exploded promulgation, if you like, of brain foods, supplements, etc., nootropics. I think they're commonly referred to now in the buzz circles. But looking at longevity first, we did a show a few months back, and it was entitled "You Are What You Eat," and I know we expanded on things that you consume can definitely affect your emotion and your psychology. With respect to longevity, you've written in your recent newsletter that the intestinal tract of parrots and ravens contained only a few species of bacteria, and this positively correlated with longevity in these species, the intestines being a major source of toxin. And it was quite, I was quite shocked when I saw it, because I know that ravens are carrion birds, and you would think that dead and dying tissue and rotting flesh would be a pretty good source of a wide range of bacteria. So in terms of bacterial toxins in the gut and the bacteria, what have you found about the intestinal population of bacteria?
Well, birds have a very high body temperature and so probably have extremely fast digestion and ability to extract everything good from the food, taking it away from a potential bacteria. So it's just so fast that the bacteria don't have much of a chance at multiplying. And incidentally, besides being very long-lived, those birds are extremely intelligent, can solve extremely complex problems very quickly. There's a lot of stuff on the internet, videos about birds solving problems. So I think the cognition and longevity go closely together. When you cause animals to live, to grow up their whole life free of bacteria, they have some advantage in stress resistance and have a somewhat increased average lifespan, a high metabolic rate. A lot of the stuff produced by the bacteria ends up simply slowing metabolism. And the aging process itself, right from earliest life, is a process of slowing the metabolic rate. So things that retard that slowing should extend lifespan as well as good cognition.
That actually reminds me of another phrase, the Wear or tear, wear and tear, sorry, wear and tear, and the relationship between activity and running at a high metabolic rate and running out of energy and or wearing out, being kind of the opposite of what we're saying here about a highly increased metabolic rate being actually productively beneficial for the organism in terms of clearing waste material and or processing reactions that would denature toxins or clear waste, etc.
When I was in grade school and high school, it was common opinion that if you were very active, had a high metabolic rate, that you would die young. And that always annoyed me, that people had the image of a candle, the brighter it burns, the shorter its life expectancy.
Is this why a baby starts out with such a high pulse rate and is so warm and has that high metabolism, and then it's just aging that changes that?
Puberty especially, it gradually slows down. When a calf is born, for example, its fats all through its body, including its brain, are highly saturated because the mother has been saturating the fats from the food. And so it's protected from the environment. And as its tissues absorb the polyunsaturated fats, its metabolism slows down. And you can see it in the ruminants because they start life extremely free of polyunsaturates. But human babies are, according to some fat experts, everyone is born deficient in the essential fatty acids, and so they advocate putting more of them in baby formula. But actually, those are major things in slowing the metabolic rate, and they tend to accumulate in the brain with aging, slowing metabolism, especially the ability to metabolize glucose all the way to carbon dioxide, so that the old or demented brain has a chronically high level of lactic acid because it has progressively lost the ability to oxidize glucose to carbon dioxide.
And a lot of polyunsaturated fats. I just find it strange that the placenta filters out the polyunsaturated fats.
That's why babies are born with a so-called fatty acid deficiency, but that's a natural thing. The baby makes its brain fats out of the glucose or fructose that it's getting from the mother.
I know, it's just so strange that they say, oh, the baby has a deficiency, when maybe that's how it's supposed to be. If that's the way it is, if the placenta filters it out, maybe the baby's not supposed to have them. So don't start giving your baby fish oil as soon as it's born.
There have been experiments with rats and dogs and other animals in which the mother is given a high unsaturated fat diet or a PUFA-free diet. And the babies have a bigger brain and a better problem-solving ability when their mother was free of PUFA during gestation.
Okay. So the first thing then, the intestines being clean is because of being a major source of toxins, definitely accumulates inflammatory degradative processes and contributes to a shorter lifespan. How about the manipulation of hormones then? And I know there was an experiment that I'd like you to bring out. I know we can't do it to human beings, perhaps, or people off the street, but a fellow called W.D. Denklas did an experiment removing the pituitary gland, and this was shown decisively to increase life and reduce the rate of aging, and the hormones that are born by both the anterior and posterior pituitary, things that I know you've mentioned lots of in the past, things like LH, FSH, TSH, and oxytocin, also very responsible for a lot of inflammatory processes.
He found that in general, the pituitary extract, if you injected it into an animal, slowed the ability to oxidize glucose. And so he called the death hormone, the oxygen blocking hormone, and he tried to extract a specific protein. It was closely related to prolactin or growth hormone, but he never did identify a single protein, probably because several pituitary hormones do have some oxygen blocking function. Growth hormone is really an adequate model of what Denkle was looking for. He thought it was closer to prolactin, but that whole range of either prolactin or growth hormone can interfere with oxygen metabolism, and it's now widely recognized that the more growth hormone you have, the shorter your life expectancy.
And I think doctors give patients growth hormone.
Yeah. The famous Methuselah mouse is deficient, lacks the ability to produce growth hormone. And when they genetically modify mice so that they produce more than the normal amount, they're very short-lived. So it's just anything you can do. You don't have to do surgery on the pituitary. You can live in a way that reduces the activity of those hormones. For example, when you get hypoglycemia, and any stress tends to sharply decrease your blood sugar until you adapt. But simply an episode of hypoglycemia increases your growth hormone, and that activates the whole process of changing your type of metabolism, blocking oxygen production relatively, the ability to oxidize glucose to carbon dioxide, and it tends to increase phosphate, which is one of the things that happens under the influence of bowel toxins.
And it's the ratio of phosphates to calcium that you've always mentioned as being important to get dietarily, so that you get enough calcium in relation to phosphate, because the phosphate from meats, particularly muscle meats, etc., and nuts and things, can be fairly damaging.
I mean, yeah, it's now considered one of the most important toxins of kidney disease, or uremic toxins.
Mm-hmm.
Simply natural phosphate that everyone has circulating, but when it increases because of the hormonal metabolic problems, that is a typical strong sign of the aging process. And the aging or anti-aging hormone or protein called Klotho is a very powerful regulator of the balance and handling of phosphate.
Okay, so carrying on with the topic of longevity and brain foods, I think actually before I start that up, I just wanted to mention that last month we did a little expose of two gifted young individuals who had an idea, and they just followed it up and did a an interview with six leading alternative scientists. Dr. Pete was one of them, and they had a Kickstarter, and they produced a documentary, and it was their goal to produce a full film all about all the some of the misleading thoughts in medicine, and how medicine and science has kind of gone off the straight and narrow and become fairly deranged in its beliefs. And Brad Adams wanted to reach a goal of $35,000 for their Kickstarter to enable them to get to post-production, and then at that point they would have a very viable and tangible film to bring to bear, and would get further funding and produce it. Well, they smashed the $35,000 record, and they got $76,000 in their Kickstarter. So well done. Okay, so Dr. Pete, I wanted to also ask now about the anti-aging effect of the proposition that diluting your blood serum or your lymph can actually increase your lifespan because of removing toxins and how the kidneys themselves, when the kidneys fail, how they can damage bowel function. And I was wondering, you know, is it possible that we could practically dialyze ourselves, like, you know, patients go for dialysis when they're diabetic, etc.?
Or what about bloodletting?
Bloodletting.
Aren't blood donors have an increase? Don't blood donors have an increased lifespan?
Well, they have a lower iron, don't they?
Yeah, at least a healthy lifespan. I'm not sure about the maximum, but they are relatively free of the degenerative diseases. And animal experiments have been done now for 75 years. Is one of the simple dilution experiments where they took out a dog's blood, centrifuged it, threw away the liquid part, put a saline solution back in to replace the red blood cells, and did that repeatedly.
Wow.
So that there were enough washings that the whole animal's body fluids had been turned over and exchanged.
Wow. So the...
a decrepit old dog of, I think, something close to 20 years became frisky.
Wow.
And really effectively rejuvenated.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, I guess then obviously there's no damage to the red blood cells from centrifuging them and or any other solid matter. It's not damaged by the g-forces, and it can be resuspended in a clean fluid.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow.
And the bowel toxins are always entering the blood and having to be removed by the kidneys, but they poison not only the kidneys, but the heart and the brain and the liver and the intestine in the process of being filtered out. And so the blood contains some of these toxins, including the normal lactic acid and phosphate simply in excess, as well as the specific bacterial toxins. But also, as these toxins affect the various tissues and organs, the body produces defensive reactions.
Mm.
And these defensive reactions, including the pituitary hormones, become part of the toxic environment circulating in the fluids. And so the shift away from circulating renewal signals produced by the animal becomes gradually with the age circulating stress signals rather than renewal signals.
Mm.
And so if you put young blood into an old animal, you're causing a slight shift back towards some of the renewal signals, but you aren't necessarily decreasing the age and stress signals.
Wow.
So,
and that's very much like a bystander effect as well, right? The
It definitely is the same process that happens in the bystander effect when you injure a cell or a particular region. For example, with a beam of focused ionizing radiation, X-raying your foot or hand or tooth or whatever, that tissue emits the signals, which are the same as the aging and stress signals. And so the radiation damage is very similar to the process of aging, and the intrinsic regulatory processes, instead of being increasing your ability to adapt, they start narrowing the way you're adapting. And it creates a vicious circle, for example, in which something interferes with your oxidation, and in reaction, that leads to lactic acid production instead of carbon dioxide. And the lactic acid is one of the toxins that turns on the production of nitric oxide, which spreads inflammatory signals and blocks the ability to use oxygen. So you get in that case, it's a very quick feedback process in which it just gets worse and worse unless something intervenes to either stop the production of lactic acid or of nitric oxide.
Wow. Okay, excellent. I think if you were to ask people on the streets whether nitric oxide was bad for you or good for you, I think most of them would say that it was good for you. It's so wrong.
The September issue of Life Extension magazine has an article mentioned on their cover how to increase your nitric oxide.
Oh, my goodness.
And it gives a several-page article describing their product that contains some very nice flavonoid compounds extracted from oranges or something.
Right.
But the theory that they use to sell them is that they will increase your nitric oxide. They give two references saying that. And so I looked up that subject, what hesperidin does to...
Hesperidin?
To nitric oxide. And I found, I don't know, I think it was probably 30 or 40 articles saying that these are anti-inflammatory because they block nitric oxide.
Right. So they got it.
So people will feel better using them, but they're selling them on it as it's an increasing nitric oxide when in fact it's doing the opposite.
Yeah.
Whoops. I wonder that they, I wonder if the editor might appreciate the comment. Okay.
I know. Someone should write to the editor of Life Extension magazine.
Okay. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Galbaville 91.1 FM. And from 7:30 till the end of the show, 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions directly related or unrelated to this month's subject of longevity and brain foods. I think in the next half an hour here, we'll get into some of the brain foods. People might have heard about them. People might have used them. I know Dr. Pete certainly knows what he's talking about, and some of the science that might support some of these brain foods, I know that he would have alternative information that I think people should be aware of. Some of them are very innocuous. Some of them have a very good background. Some of them have a very less than scientific background. So brain foods, I think, is going to be the next thing that we'll get into. But if people have any questions about them or about longevity or how to approach that, 923-3911 or the 1-800 number is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. So the subject of nootropics being the word that's used to describe a product that would be an improving your cognitive ability, your mental prowess, your performance skills, etc., and your alertness and readiness. There's lots and lots out there, and I'm not surprised that most people don't really understand it and probably bite the hook that's the shiniest and glossiest and fanciest hook. It looks like it must work because it's got such a good such a good advertising campaign behind it. I wanted to explore then the subject of nootropics with you, Dr. Pete, and ask whether you can support or refute the claims made by various manufacturers of performance and cognition improving substances as plausible or poor science. And I think wanted to start with a widely known in the trade anyway, a compound called acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter responsible for improving memory, learning, problem-solving ability, and general cognition. What are your thoughts on this substance?
The current and the last 20 years popular medical approach to treating Alzheimer's disease is to try to increase the level or production or persistence of acetylcholine by blocking the enzyme that breaks it down. And they've demonstrated basically that it doesn't work. And so they need a new fundamental theory, but their theory is so mistaken that it's hard for them to get off onto a new line of drug treatment because the acetylcholine, it's essential and part of our conscious regulating. It's needed for memory. All kinds of biological processes require just the right amount of acetylcholine. But it activates the enzyme that produces nitric oxide.
Uh-oh.
And nitric oxide blocks energy production. And so the process of excitotoxicity, which it made monosodium glutamate notorious because a little too much of that activates the production of a little too much acetylcholine, and that makes too much nitric oxide. Uh-huh. Nitric oxide poisons the ability to oxidize glucose to carbon dioxide, so it increases lactic acid, and
Oops.
The cell has less energy and is more excited by the acetylcholine, so basically it becomes susceptible to dying in proportion to the overstimulation of acetylcholine.
And is it true that MSG can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause that reaction in the brain?
Oh, sure. The amino acids all have to get into the brain to provide brain proteins and such. And it's just one of our normal amino acids, but too much of it becomes toxic, or too little of the other amino acids, and a relative disproportion of glutamic acid.
So,
aspartic acid and cysteine are the other potential nerve toxins. Again, by increasing acetylcholine, which increases nitric oxide, blocks oxygen metabolism of glucose.
Oops. So another good case in point of more is not better. In your opinion, do you think most people have enough acetylcholine in their systems?
Yeah, actually, I think the tendency with aging is to have too much.
Right.
The shock reaction is, for over 100 years now, there's been evidence that overactivity of the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic nerve system produces shock, that it's the essential factor in shock. And this is the system that acts primarily through acetylcholine, producing nitric oxide. Nitric oxide blocks oxygen metabolism. So in shock, your blood stays red and full of oxygen, but the tissue can't use it. And that happens with aging, heart failure, kidney failure, dementia, all the tissues relatively have a shock-like metabolism that progresses with aging.
Do you think there's any medical benefit or interest in increasing the breakdown of acetylcholine?
There are lots of therapeutic uses of things that block the overactivity of acetylcholine and accelerate its turnover. A rich environment increases the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine.
So the environmental enrichment then would encourage the breakdown of acetylcholine.
Having a good life protects you against too much.
It protects you against lots of aging problems, right?
What?
Having a good life protects you against lots of aging.
Well,
problems.
You have to clarify the term "good life." We don't mean we don't mean drinking and partying and
no,
what we're
no having. Having lots of fun, reading interesting things, talking to interesting people.
Yeah, and having an interesting job to do, an interesting work, and liking your job, not because it pays you well, but because you're fundamentally interested in it, which is what you should always pursue in your life.
Yeah.
Don't
you? It might pay well, too.
Well, that's a benefit. That's a positive benefit, and that's a blessing, but it's not
that's
always...
the opposite of learned helplessness.
Right.
Or behavioral despair.
Okay.
Most people treat their jobs with some learned helplessness.
How can they do anything different? They spend all this time, well, perhaps in some instances, they spend all the time studying for a particular degree or whatever education, and then they get into the work and find out how odious it is and decide that, what can they do about it? I don't know. Okay, yeah, learned helplessness, another very interesting topic. I know we've spent quite a bit of time talking about learned helplessness and how that plays psychologically into physiology and how it can have definite effects on the organism in terms of decreasing its survival odds.
I mean, that brings up another product line that is being pushed recently, the methylating agents, because learned helplessness is a matter of imprinting, turning off the genes that should enliven you, increase your adaptability. Too much methylation shuts things down, makes you helpless. And that process happens progressively with aging. Too much methylation turns off the genes of renewal. And there are lots of products pushing the idea that we need more methylation.
Oh, gosh.
One of the main methyl donors is methionine, the amino acid.
Mm-hmm.
And it, if you deprive animals of a major part, I forget the exact percentage, but half or less of their normal methionine, they live 30 or 40% longer than they would otherwise.
What's a common food source that's high in methionine?
All of the high-protein foods like meats.
Okay, so this, again, another good reason to advocate the fact that muscle meats in isolation are not good for you, and that balanced proteins from the whole animal, with including the connective tissue and gelatin, is the best way to consume a protein.
Yeah, gelatin is unique in being free of the pro-aging amino acids. And another bad thing about meat is its very high ratio of phosphate to calcium.
And so is this similar to adventuresomeness?
To what?
Adventuresomeness. It's a phrase that my dad's always using, that he reads articles about people and cultures that have more adventuresomeness than others.
More adventure, yeah.
They're into adventure.
That's what
environmental enrichment.
An enriched environment gives you the opportunity to have adventure every day.
Yeah, good. Allows your brain to grow and to seek new opportunities and with limitless potentials. That's what life should be all about. Okay, there's a little one-liner I just wanted to mention here, which kind of really supports the whole energy metabolism, or the increased energy, increased metabolism being very pro-life. Was that there's a little sentence here that was part of your newsletter, Dr. Pete. You said that heart rate corresponding with academic standing in elderly patients improved when their pacemaker was turned up.
They had noticed that people with a faster heart rate had higher academic records, and they thought maybe it was just a better brain circulation. People with a very slow heart rate weren't getting enough oxygen to their brain, so they had patients with the adjustable pacemakers, and so they gave them mental tests when it was set at 70 beats per minute, and then they turned up the rate to 85 beats per minute, gave them the same tests, and they scored better in all types of brain function, memory, reasoning.
Yeah. And it's so popular in culture to believe that if you have a low pulse rate, you're healthy, you're fit, you're super athletic, you know. And like these people that have pulses of 50 beats a minute, they suddenly die of heart attacks. They're not long-lived at all. And it's a complete brainwashing that low heart rate corresponds with longevity, because it's the opposite.
It's the bodybuilders that live a long time, not the long-distance runners.
Well, maybe the bodybuilders might wear out their joints too, but take too many chemicals. They're definitely the big bodybuilders you see that are all over the press and news. Okay, so let's just—I just wanted to bring out a couple of nootropics that are in the herb world, and just see if there's any. I know there's a connection there, but just see the connection that there is. Sage, believe it or not, I've always known sage to be a kind of cleansing purifier, mouthwash. It can be used for, you know, boggy gums that are not holding the teeth properly. Definitely can be used for respiratory conditions. But sage apparently here now, there's fairly recent articles on PubMed that it has a cholinesterase inhibiting property. Now, this is something that you mentioned earlier on with acetylcholine. So the enzyme that produces acetylcholine is acetylcholine esterase, and salvia inhibits that.
Every plant, like every animal, has thousands of different chemicals.
Right.
And sage has, I'm not sure how it relates to other drug effects, but that is one of its components' actions, is to shift the balance to increased acetylcholine action.
Yeah.
But two of its major terpene-type chemicals are inhibitors of nitric oxide, salvia oleic acid, I think one is called.
Okay.
And the other, a Chinese or Japanese name, cathinone, something like that.
Okay.
These are very effective inhibitors of nitric oxide, so they're anti-inflammatory and pro-respiratory.
Yeah.
So is this why it probably has an action with reducing menopausal hot flashes? If it's reducing nitric oxide and...
Nitric oxide does cause flushing and is connected with hot flashes. So probably the dominant effect is to lower nitric oxide, where the cholinesterase inhibitors will tend to increase nitric oxide by stimulating the acetylcholine nerves.
Okay, well then, I guess moving on to ginkgo. Most people know ginkgo. It's been used for a long time in the Chinese traditional medicine system, more particularly for elderly people to improve cognitive function. They say that it improves blood flow to the brain, so it increases cerebral blood flow, and that would seem to be in keeping with turning up an elderly patient's pacemaker, increasing their heart rate and their cardiac output. But I think the vasodilating effects of the cerebral arteries is probably more the point with ginkgo. But I also wanted to bring out what, again, maybe miscommonly known as good when it's not, perhaps, is the link between a monoamine oxidase, and then ginkgo apparently decreases monoamine oxidase, and that increases dopamine. Now, I know they treat, well, they, unscientifically perhaps, they might treat Alzheimer's patients with L-DOPA, and dopamine might be touted as a precursor here, as a product to do that with. But what are your thoughts on dopamine and monoamine oxidases?
It definitely makes you feel good. It's sort of an upper to do anything that increases your dopamine. Tends to increase adrenaline usually, and certain types of MAO inhibitors will increase serotonin too.
Right, it's not good.
Those don't necessarily go with well-being. Brain circulation, for example, is decreased by serotonin. It tightens up the blood vessels, especially the veins leaving the brain. So if you have too much serotonin, you can get brain congestion and a migraine, for example, with the arteries opening up and the veins closing down.
Okay.
So there might be serotonin inhibitors in ginkgo, but I think the most important benefit of ginkgo is that it's a very good nitric oxide inhibitor.
And also blocks platelet aggregating factor.
Right, it's a PF blocker, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, and mentioning that, it blocks prostaglandins pretty generally.
And yes. They're pro-inflammatory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's 7:46 here on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show, 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in if you have any questions about tonight's show on longevity and brain foods. Numbers 923-3911. Or if you live outside the area, there's a 1-800 toll-free number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. So to carry on with the subject of brain foods, I know we had this conversation earlier and got into a philosophical topic of the meaning or the usefulness of the determination of intelligence when it comes to marketing a brain food as supposedly increasing your intelligence. But philosophically, in terms of what we as human beings are told by our peers and by media advertising, intelligence is not just intelligence. And that there's actually many different ways of looking at intelligence that can be useful if we don't believe the IQ is the only determinant, and if we can, do complicated mathematics in our head, that if we can't do that, there's something wrong with us, because intelligence itself can be can take on many different forms, and perhaps our society just doesn't recognize or want to recognize some of those forms.
The Wizard of Oz idea, maybe you can just go online and buy a diploma and become intelligent and qualified. It's starting to look like the mechanical idea of qualification. You learn certain techniques, like computer programming. They can break it down into little credits and micro degrees and so on, and you accumulate your qualifications in terms of what the culture has to sell. But I think the whole idea of intelligence, it's sort of like the wear and tear idea of aging. It's an idea that there's a blueprint laid out for how the body develops. It's all determined ahead of time. And the intelligence, the IQ idea, is that there are certain mental skills that an intelligent person has that you can define IQ by. One of the silliest kinds of IQ tests had questions that were simply stories that they had asked people at Oxford, I think it was, to interpret, and then they had uneducated people interpret the same story. Mm-hmm. And the IQ test asks you to interpret these little short stories, and if you do it the way the Oxford graduate did, you have a high IQ.
That is silly.
Oh dear.
So a lot of products are being sold with the idea that if you take them, you'll become clever in these ways that will make you compete in the society.
Yeah.
If the society is set up in an irrational way, then it's not intelligent to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
In terms that the society presents.
Yeah, that reminds me of the caste system in India. I read a BBC News article just the other day about a chap in India who had 6 degrees. He had a couple of master's degrees in various different subjects. But unfortunately for him, he was of a certain caste. He was of a caste that actually was, I forget the name they gave them now, but they were basically a caste that was relegated to cleaning up human waste. And no matter how many degrees this chap had, and he got time off to go to university and to study for his exams, etc., and he passed one after the other, and they started getting wise to him wanting all this time off and started to try to block him, but he actually just protested against it, and eventually he won and was given the time off to do these extra degrees, and they still wouldn't do anything about him in terms of his social standing, because they'd already compartmentalized him. And that's very much the opposite of what we talk about with environmental enrichment and the kind of things that that can bring to society as a whole, and also to individuals that can then affect other individuals. Very much a kind of a brainwashing of systems of a certain type of belief.
The nootropic people are really committed to the idea of intelligence as competition,
right,
to gain status. But I think there's a more general idea of consciousness and intelligence that applies to life in general, that it's an appropriateness of, right, the way you live, which is intelligent, not the skill you have to fit into whatever you might encounter in the society. It's the ability to decide whether you want to fit in or not.
Yeah. I think also the quotient here of fitting in terms of feeling alive and well, I think is very important. And obviously, we've talked at length in the past about various toxic insults in our food supply, in our environment, you know, what people consider normal in terms of their pastimes or their free time or their occupation or just in their thoughts. And, you know, you mentioned learned helplessness and the kind of inescapable stress and that kind of events that promotes. But just having an open and free outlook and, or like I said, a job that not necessarily pays well, but that you really enjoy is so much more important. And, in terms of IQ, as you've mentioned, it's a really false, in a lot of ways, a false system of, determining intelligence, and that society itself is very much molded, unfortunately, by the huge corporations that surround us selling whatever products they have to offer. And so when I started looking at neurotrophics, it's a pretty endless sort of list, and it's gone on from one to the next, and I know that Life Extension magazine definitely promotes a lot of life-promoting products. And so there are definitely some products, of course, that, like you mentioned, things like thyroid, things like pregnenolone, anti-stress, basic anti-stress chemicals, compounds that are naturally produced by the body to offset the toxic effects of stress and the inflammatory effects of stress.
And vitamins are important.
Yeah, I was going to mention B12. I know you mentioned B1 and then B12. A fairly realistically important, you know, anti-stress and thereby perhaps, you know, memory or cognition enhancing products.
A niacinamide.
Caffeine, if it's used properly, but a lot of people are thinking of caffeine as a legal version of crack cocaine. And it shouldn't be used as speed. It should be used as a food. It should decrease nitric oxide exposure, and so it should have anti-aging properties. But if you take it on an empty stomach, it will drop your blood sugar, turn on nitric oxide, and cause aging stress.
So have caffeine after you've had a big meal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to bring out one particular herb, just because it's kind of pertinent to the subject of nootropics or performance enhancing, and it's actually under the umbrella of the general term adaptogenics, which was coined and by Russian research when they were looking at cheap alternatives to drugs that they perhaps couldn't produce in the 50s for their space program. They were very much into looking at plant sources, and the ginsengs, obviously, are one of those kind of crowning products that you think about when you think about both longevity and enhancing mental performance, etc. But that resistance, that term adaptogen, coined to describe a compound that improved the organism's resistance to stress. So the Korean ginseng, Panax ginseng, is one of those things, obviously, that I think of, along with Eleutherococcus and several other ginseng species. Okay, I kind of think that's coming towards the end of the show. I think we want to just do another shout out here. Did you want to come on in? Oh, somebody's on the phone, are they? Well, we've got 4 minutes. I don't think we can take it, because it's going to push us over 8 o'clock and they'll be unhappy people. But perhaps if they want to call in, I'll take the call afterwards, perhaps, and we can do that. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Pete.
Okay, thank you.
I just want
thank you and good night, Dr. Pete.
Good night. Good night.
Okay, so I just want to let people know in the next few minutes here a little bit more about Dr. Pete, how they can find out about him, read his work, look at all the stuff that he's published, get a feel for him from the shows. Hopefully, at any moment soon, perhaps within the next month, the website that we have will be updated, and it is my intention to post all of the audios that we've done with Dr. Pete. I think there's getting on for 50 at least of them, and publish those for people to freely download and listen to. Dr. Pete's website, www.raypete.com, is full of articles, fully referenced, all of it's his research, his own unique way of looking at all the pieces and bringing together a cohesive framework within which to understand what medicine so often tries to hit with a hammer with a single drug in large amounts, or toxic drugs that have negative effects. So Dr. Pete has a very unique way of looking at things, and I know from personal experience a lot of what he has brought out to us and taught us has really helped a lot of people. So his website's a very good starting point to look at articles.
And that's www.raypete.com.
And my name's Andrew Murray.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray.